Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today, in the studio with me, Dr. Elaine Aron, who has written a book that has been, well, kind of remarkable because it was brought to my attention by a dear friend who's also in the studio with me today, Dr. Michael Morrison. Michael's been a buddy of mine for a long time. He's a psychotherapist. And he brought Elaine Aron to my attention. He said, have you seen this highly sensitive person's stuff? And that started us going. And then we realized that we know Elaine because we knew of you. We know of your husband's work. We've been around here, and then this whole kind of thing came together, and then Michael happens to be in the neighborhood. So, Michael, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks, Armand.
Nice to have you here. Nice.
Great to meet you, Dr. Aron.
Oh. And Elaine is happy to be here because it's Pacifica Radio.
Yes.
And she has an experience with Pacifica as well.
Oh, yes.
And we're
yes.
having a good time. Let's talk about this highly sensitive person stuff.
Yeah.
What is a highly sensitive person?
Well, they have have an innate trait of being more aware of subtleties and therefore being also more easily overwhelmed, meaning that they need more downtime. But that's kind of the difficult part of the trait. The important thing here is the awareness of subtleties and awareness of what the past has done to create the present, awareness of how the present is going to be likely to evolve into the future, awareness of how our actions affect other people, so that sensitive people are highly conscientious. It's a pretty good trait.
You say the highly sensitive person is a pretty good trait. I always thought that when somebody says you're highly sensitive, it means you get hurt too easily.
Well, there's that. There is a kind of a vulnerability, but, what do we mean by being hurt too easily? If I tell my surgeon that I want him to be careful, am I going to be hurting his feelings? I'm hoping that he'll get it. I hope he'll really get it. So too sensitive is in the eyes of the beholder. If 20% of people have this trait, that means 80% of them don't. And
well,
if 80%,
let me ask you, if 20% of the people are highly sensitive people, then we could say these would make great tasters, they would make great smellers, these would be great people who would be great in art, in the arts in general, their sensitivities are beautiful. Mm-hmm. They would be great in love because they could probably love more deeply than other people can. Mm-hmm. It's good, but they're going to cry.
Mm-hmm. They're going to cry. They have stronger emotional reactions, and they do take negative feedback very seriously, because really their strategy in the world is, you could say, do it once, do it right. Observe carefully, understand, and then act. So, yeah, they do, their feelings do get hurt. Their self-esteem can be a bit lower because of that. Plus, the society in which a sensitive person is very important. There was a study done comparing Chinese and Canadian elementary school children. This is a while back before China began its rather drastic changes, but they found that sensitive, quiet children in China were the most popular with their peers. In Canada, sensitive, quiet children were the least popular with their peers.
How would you account for that difference?
Well, I account for it that immigrant cultures usually have sorted out for it. They prefer people who can stand a lot, who can endure a lot, and who are not overly sensitive.
We don't have room for people who can't endure when you are the new group coming in.
Exactly.
We don't want you to take too many of the available resources, like needing our handkerchiefs when you cry. We don't want that. We want you to stand up on your own, and if you're going to bleed, bleed, but stand right there, you know?
Whereas a society that's been around longer tends to develop traditions and manners and the arts and all, in which actually sensitivity is more appreciated. Also, as a culture is more aggressive, sensitivity is not appreciated as much.
Does that kind of sensitivity lead to shyness automatically?
Absolutely not. I define shyness as the fear of social judgment. I don't think anybody is born with that fear. That's a fear that's created. In fact, I don't, you know, there are some specific fears like of spiders and heights and things like that. I don't think it makes sense that anybody's born afraid. That's something that happens through experiences. But sensitive people do at the extent to want to observe before entering into a group. So like I watched both my son and my nephew the first day of preschool. They had never seen so many toys and children in all their life. You know, they were only 3 or 4 years old. So they're standing and watching. Teacher comes up and says, "What's the matter? Are you shy? Are you afraid?" So there goes the label right away. What's that little boy like to think? Maybe I am shy. Maybe I am afraid. There must be something wrong with that. There must be something wrong with me. It's going to be hard to enter into this group. They try to enter in, and one of the things that happens with sensitive people is we're more easily overstimulated, more easily over-aroused. So when we try to make small talk or something like that, we're often not at our best. So you can see how a person would become shy.
I noticed you used a collective we.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
No problem. You consider yourself to be a highly sensitive person?
Yeah, and I don't think I could have written this book without that, because this is looking at something from the inside
right,
out.
Right, because you do it in the accusatory way, the highly sensitive person.
Well, what happens when someone is not doing something? We project onto them. So the person may be stupid. They may have emotional problems. They may seem fearful. They may seem aloof. They may seem all kinds of things when a person's not doing something. So the fact is, if you're highly sensitive, what's going on is that you're processing information more deeply, and you're not doing anything while you do that. And how's anybody going to know that's what you're doing except you?
Which leads me to one of the things that Michael brought to my attention about this. Michael, you want to mention that? About why it was what you
remind me.
Well, you talked about the person when they do feel a pain, how long it takes to recover.
Right. That is one of the elements of the highly sensitive person, Dr. Aaron's writings, that struck me right away and something I identified with. And I kind of extend by extension, I try to kind of include everybody and say that. Let's see, is it an HSP type, a particular type, or does everybody have a vulnerabilities or sensitivities, areas? And maybe it's not as dominant as the person who would be kind of classified as the highly sensitive person. I could definitely personally identify with the slow recovery, and I immediately, and bring me back if I'm getting too personal here, I immediately linked it with my bunch of places in my own personal history, you know, going at least back into adolescence, if not, and childhood. I had a lot of childhood trauma from moving, where it just seemed like stuff would happen and I would be thrown off for not hours, but weeks and months. And as an adult in a comfortable place, think, you know, things are okay and, you know, nothing profound is happening. Suddenly, you know, there would be some incident and I would think that was okay, you know, I should blow by this, you know, and I'm a trained, highly trained person. And no, it persisted. And so that led me to really be attracted to the work.
How would you account for that, Elaine? So there it is, that kind of wound that goes all the way down there with a highly sensitive person. When they feel a pain, it goes, I get hurt, I get over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you about some fantastic research that's being done right now, which is that they have, this sensitivity has always been understood as being a vulnerability, that sensitive people are more vulnerable to depression. My husband and I did a study in which, you know, when people describe a bad childhood, sensitive people with a difficult childhood are far more likely to be depressed, anxious, and shy than a non-sensitive person with a similar childhood. But if they have a good childhood, they're no more depressed, anxious, and shy than anybody else. But they're still, or have these emotional reactions. And then what they discovered, other people have been looking at this in a number of studies, they see now that sensitive children growing up in a supportive environment, and I think this can extend to adulthood too, are actually more emotionally and physically healthy and more resilient than other kids. I hate to say that because I don't want to make this into some kind of a special group, but that's just what the research is showing. So there's a susceptibility rather than a vulnerability, that there's potential on both sides.
Well, wait, now wait a minute, Elaine. Wouldn't I imagine that people who have what they call nervous breakdowns are the highly sensitive people?
More often, and one of the problems for sensitive people is that they're the ones that are obvious and stand out. Most sensitive people with a supportive background have learned to blend. They're a minority. There's a self-test in my book and on my website with about 27 questions in it. And sensitive people, some people will answer yes to every one of them. There are people who answer no to every one of them. That's a huge difference. I think it's as big as gender, but it's invisible. And it brings up an interesting topic, Michael, about sensitive men. And I can say quite a bit on that subject.
Good, let's talk about sensitive men.
It's a rough thing to be in this culture, obviously. And so sensitive men, like on the self-test, they tend to score lower on it. When I bring it up with a sensitive man, there's always something goes on right away. There's tenseness. There's, I don't know if I'm one, or what is this thing, or of course not, or joking or whatever. And I don't look down on them. I simply know that there's a complex there. There's a huge wound that began probably with, you're a crybaby, because sensitive people feel physical pain more. So what happens when a kid in kindergarten, a boy in kindergarten, falls down and hurts himself and cries? More emotional reaction, more physical pain, more emotional pain. And, boy, he learns right away that he'd better not show that. And the lucky ones maybe have body builds that you don't think of this person as sensitive. I don't see any relationship between body build and sensitivity. But the ones who are slighter or shorter, then it's really easy to label them. And just to let me go into the animal research and then come back to men and be sure we come back. A number of biologists have been identifying that rather than there being sort of a perfect evolutionary goal for, say, an elephant in a forest, that there's a certain perfect elephant for living in a forest, and that's the one that's going to survive best. Now we know that over 100 species, and probably all species perhaps, because this is fruit flies, it's fish, it's dogs, it's primates and humans, have two personalities at least. I mean, two major, you might call them bedding styles. One is to be cautious, to watch, to observe, and don't make a move until you know you're right. The other one is to boldly go where no one's gone before. So you take two deer on the edge of a meadow, and one of them, they're both, of course, sensitive, but one of them is very sensitive, isn't going to step out and eat the grass until absolutely certain there's no predator there. The other one is looking around, checks it out, and goes out. Now, if there's a predator there, the sensitive one was right. If there was no predator there, the sensitive one doesn't get the best grass. So it's simply, which technique are you born with a preference for using? Now, if you
want...
Which
brings us back to men.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Because women, as a gender, have a survival strategy, which is to take care of themselves. They can only have so many children. I had to go off into evolutionary biology, but sometimes it's quite useful. You can only have so many, bear so many children, so you take care of your body. Men take care of the woman's body, by protecting her. Well, the strategy of a sensitive animal, male or female, is to take care of himself. So a sensitive man can look a lot like he's doing what women do.
Wait, let me get that again. He looks like he's taking care of himself.
He is taking care of himself. That's his strategy. So, for instance, an animal, so the males are all fighting over the females, and they're getting hurt. They're getting wounded, mortally wounded, some of them. There's another strategy. Watch all of this, and when they're all exhausted, go and mate with the females. Very often the females prefer the sensitive males. And you can see this in, not, obviously not fruit flies and pumpkin seed sunfish, as far as I know, but you can certainly see it in many mammals. So that's a strategy that works very well. Another one, take famine. So the bullies are getting all the best food spots, and the sensitive ones are having to go and find some food spots that nobody else noticed. In a famine, who's doing well? So, but while, you know, so the sensitive male animal is not fighting over the food, but observing what's going on.
So it's very likely at 4 o'clock in the dance club, at 4 a.m., you're going to find sensitive young men, because at midnight and 1 o'clock, the other guys, they took the girls home.
Yeah,
you're more likely to find
right, because it's not the ideal situation for a sensitive person in general. I like to say that we don't make good first impressions. We make tremendous second impressions, unless we develop a lot of social skill.
Well, as well as that, I mean, in your second impression, you have a certain stick-to-itiveness that you may not have if you're a less sensitive person. Mm-hmm. There's a part of you that kind of digests and takes in the entire thing. So you're there for longer.
Right. And one of the things, my husband's not highly sensitive. My son is kind of in between. The two of them, so we're talking in the car. The two of them are talking about something, and I'm thinking about what they're talking about, and I'm about to say something about that subject, and they have moved on to another subject. And I just can't think as fast as they are. Michael's nodding. And after a while, you begin to feel kind of left out. On the other hand, sensitive people, we just recently found in a study, analyzed some data, sensitive people are more bored in their relationships. Because if you can't have a deep conversation, they just as soon not have a conversation at all.
Oh, is that true, Michael? You know,
I mean,
I'm going to be careful.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, it's funny.
It's easy to I mean, you don't have to have a sensitive
I've known Michael
person.
For 30 years, and in my loving him and over the time, over this period of time, there are a number of times when that's happened where we'll have a conversation and
there's
then
a speed differential.
Right. There's a real speed differential. I'm on to my seventh subject and he's just having his appetizer.
Well, I'm having that. I was commenting about that happens between me and you.
Yeah.
As I'm having trouble keeping up because you're going here and you're going there and I'm still thinking about that last subject.
That original subject. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm keeping quiet to let you let it maturate.
Okay.
So I'll push in.
Go ahead.
Because you wanted to bring it back to men.
Mm-hmm.
I only know about myself.
Yes.
Primarily. But as the best authority. Something I think about sensitive types, or it may be something we could say on behalf of psychotherapy, as an aid to this process, in developing resilience, you have no choice but have to work through stuff because the stuff comes up. Yeah, you know, and I would say, you know, we talked before, even introduced as sensitive people get hurt more or hurt too easily. And I would change the language of that a little bit and say they get shocked more or upset more. In my own explorations, you know, one of the other most profound books that I've read or areas is about shame. The work of Gershon Kaufman, who is a national and international authority on shame, I stumbled onto and said, wow, that's what's happening. You know, at least some of the time I'm having shame reactions and I'm withdrawing and going down immediately. But I think that this, so it's not just hurt easily, it's, and I'm, and I don't want to say that it's just shame, but it's upset. It's there's something we get shocked. And
we have to process stuff more. And when we're done processing, we've often come to some way that we're handling it better. One of the questions I used to have on my questionnaire that sensitive people answer yes to and non-sensitive people don't is, would you be willing to sit at the bedside of a dying stranger and comfort them? Sensitive people have thought an awful lot about death. They can't help it, you know. They're just it's there. They're vulnerable to those feelings. So we have to come to some, not necessarily a, you know, nobody comes to a final brilliant solution to the problem of death, but having thought about it, almost like being comfortable with having to think about it. And the same, I think, is true with shame. You have enough experience of shame, you've got to work on that issue. You've got to work on it. Kindness, we need kindness. And we're attracted to kindness just like a moth to a flame, kind of. Have to learn how to manage even that attraction, not to let it overwhelm you. So I think you're right. And, you know, shame registers in the brain in the same place as physical pain. So we're just more sensitive to both. And shame, I think, evolved as a reaction to, you know, avoid being thrown out of the group. And so it's a survival strategy.
But how did that work? How did that work? Did shame evolve as a way of not being thrown out of a group?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
Well, you've got to be sensitive to what the other members really don't like being totally selfish.
Mm-hmm.
So we learn what the group doesn't like. Usually our parents teach us that. And we have an intense reaction of total worthlessness when we do certain things. That is taught what the things are, but the reaction is innate. And it's very strong in a sensitive person because part of their survival strategy is to know what's shameful and not to do it. Which is heavy. It's very primal.
Very, very primal.
My guest is Dr. Elaine Aaron and Michael Morrison. The name of the book, The Highly Sensitive Person, which Elaine has written. Elaine, you know, when we're talking about the highly sensitive person, we also think about people and what they call histrionics, hysteria, that kind of thing. Where do you go with that? Are you going to defend it and say, oh, no, just because they're crying at the drop of a hat, just because every time you say that there's something wrong, they take it personally? You going to defend that, or are you going to say, get some help?
Well, I think that it's a problem of what you mean by sensitivity, obviously, and what I mean by sensitivity is this processing things more deeply.
That's reactivity.
Sure.
Great. It's a
right.
big difference.
Right. So a person who's been traumatized has PTSD. They're sensitive, but they're sensitive in a different way. They're hypervigilant, but it's different. And a person, histrionic personality disorders, borderline personality disorders, you can almost always see the history that's led to this, and temperament then interacts with it. But it's really different from the kind of sensitivity I'm talking about. Now, I've just finished and about to have published a book with Rutledge called Psychotherapy and the Highly Sensitive Person. And I have a whole section about distinguishing sensitivity from the various DSM diagnoses, but also what
we
it looks...
We seem to be more related to reactivity. Mm-hmm. The DSM diagnosis seem to be the reaction that a person has is more than the sensitivity itself. It's not what you feel. It's how you behave, how you react.
Well, certainly that's part of it is emotional regulation. And sensitive people usually have learned a lot of emotional regulation to deal with their intense emotionality. But particularly if a child has grown up with parents who cannot regulate their emotion, who over or under regulate, then you often see adults, you know, they grow up and they don't know how to regulate their emotion. They have intense issues going on, like the fear of abandonment, that supersede any kind of caution. So sometimes people who have had a really bad childhood behave very impulsively, which is not typical of a sensitive person, but all kinds of things can override the sensitivity. So you also have to think about what sensitivity looks like along with the DSM diagnosis. So, you know, each person also has other temperament traits and has an enormous amount of history. So I'm forced to make generalizations that make me uncomfortable to make them, but what do you do?
So you said you work with, there are two kinds of sensitive people. Some people are aggressive. You know, aggressively sensitive. I mean, they react by becoming violent.
Well, actually, I was saying that that's rare. That's rare because the opposite of being sensitive is being impulsive. And emotional expressions that are too violent usually get a violent reaction. And sensitive people cannot deal with that. I mean, some of them do dish out more than they can handle. But generally, they also, sensitive people are able or almost forced by their nature to understand what the other person is feeling to some itty-bitty extent. So usually a person who's very who's highly sensitive but also has some real characterological problems will will feel that they're demanding, and then they'll be afraid that they're too much for you. And their fear goes more to being too much because they can feel all this emotional turmoil inside. They can feel anger if they're very, very secure, but they're not the kinds that bring out guns or, you know, threaten to come to, you know, stalk you or something like that. It's too much shame about those kind of behaviors.
It's very difficult to feel, to live with that level of it. Like you said, women for some reason are allowed this. You know, women are allowed tears. Women are allowed to be sensitive. Women are therefore, by their sensitivities, considered to be lesser beings by many men. Because, yeah, there she is. She's crying. Of course, who cares? Mm-hmm. Who understands what that's about?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't value the sensitivity.
Right.
Unless
and they associate
it
with women, which is where sensitive men have a hard time.
Unless they're going to exploit it. And when I say exploit it, I don't mean that as judgmentally as it sounds. Because for the man who doesn't have the senses, it's wonderful to be loving somebody who does have the senses.
Mm-hmm.
And to be close to somebody who could feel so much is such a tremendous thing.
It's true, but I have to emphasize that a sensitive man married or in a relationship with a non-sensitive woman, the situation really can be reversed, that the woman gets a great deal from the man's sensitivity that she doesn't notice. And it's different with a sensitive man, but it's a very precious thing between two people, that one person really can gain a lot from the other person's sensitivity. When I wrote this book, Chapter 7 is on relationships, I wrote the chapter, I showed it to my husband, and we actually had an argument about it because he said, you're writing as though what a sensitive person in a relationship, a sensitive person gains from having a non-sensitive person to take care of things and, you know, sort of be a buffer against everything. But you haven't said a word about what the non-sensitive person gains from the sensitive person. I actually couldn't see it. Hmm. Well, we had lots of talks about it. Temperament, understanding temperament is a fantastic thing in relationships. You know, somebody did a study and found that divorce is highly heritable. 42% of your odds of being divorced are determined by your genes.
Hmm.
However, what that's really about, I think, is ignorance of temperament. Because, you know, if two people have different temperaments, they're going to have arguments about temperament that are really sad because there are things you can't change in another person because of their sensitivity. So kind of like that thing that you used to, there's lots of things that you're born with, genetic, and you can become retarded or something like that. Until you find out about, then you treat it. The same thing with temperament. Once you find out about your temperament, you can handle it very differently in a relationship.
What happens, I mean, when people take antidepressants, sometimes they decrease their sensitivity. You know, I mean, part of the people who get depressed by their highly sensitive being self, what do you think?
Well, my experience with people who are highly sensitive who take antidepressants, I've never seen one become truly less sensitive in the sense of no longer processing things deeply, no longer being conscientious, no longer thinking about the other person's feelings. I don't even think it changes. The main thing that it changes is how far they can go into their depression to the point of wanting to kill themselves or something like that. And we know now that when you give antidepressants to people for something like sensitivity, it doesn't have much effect on them. It's only really deep depression that they work on anyway. But I have to say, when I first told my primary care physician about writing this book, he said, oh, great, well, that's wonderful because there's a cure for that. It's antidepressants.
My guest, Dr. Elaine Aaron, the author of the book, The Highly Sensitive Person. We're going to be taking a short break. And when we come back, my friends, we'll continue with this conversation because there's everybody wants to learn about it. You know, everybody's kind of pointed at it and said, too much, too little, what's right? We'll be back with you in just a few moments. And we're back with you at The Positive Mind. With Dr. Elaine Aaron and Michael Morrison, WBAI 99.5 FM, we're talking about the highly sensitive person. Monkeys. Talk about highly sensitive. Do you ever walk through a zoo where there are monkeys or a forest where there are monkeys? They seem to be reacting to everything.
Well, yes, and I talked about earlier that there are two personality types in most species, and a guy named Stephen Suomi has been studying in all kinds of ways rhesus monkeys. Interesting, he says that they're humans and rhesus monkeys are two species that have survived almost anywhere in the world. So he thinks that they're in many ways similar to humans. And he has identified what he calls the uptight monkeys and the laid-back monkeys, or he used to call them that. 20% of the monkeys were uptight, which meant that under stress they tended to, especially if they had a lot of stress in their childhoods, they tended to be more back off, afraid of novelty, that kind of thing, depressed after defeats, kind of low in the hierarchy often. So one of the things he did was to take some of these uptight monkeys and cross-foster them, something you can't do with humans, and give them to skilled mothers. Those uptight monkeys became the leaders of those troops of monkeys.
Now, wait a minute. He gave them to skilled mothers. What's a skilled mother?
A mother that has a fair amount of status herself, I guess. She's just, all of her children have grown up to be what we would call resilient. So I said earlier that this research about finding that sensitive children that grow up in a supportive environment actually thrive. They get more out of a good intervention or a good childhood. They soak up more benefits than other children. And that's because, again, their sensitivity makes them pick up on the nuances. And my imagination about this is that these monkeys that became the leaders of the troop were very good at noticing if they wanted to do a confrontation. They knew who to confront, when, how. Particularly good, I think, at alliances. So you could say crafty, sly, you know, and then the desire to get to the top. They can be very good at it if they haven't had such a stressful childhood that their first reaction is fear. But see, sensitivity is not about having your first reaction being fear. It's about observing.
Elaine, as somebody who's both a psychologist and you've done your work with patients, as well as somebody who's curious yourself and a highly sensitive person, you've also been very attracted to yoga and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does meditation do? Does it quell the sensitivity? Does it kind of take down the edges of it? What do you look to do?
I think after almost 40 years of meditating, I would say that the main thing it does is it gives me downtime. Sensitive people need lots of downtime. And that's with no stimulation coming in. 80% of your stimulation comes in through your eyes, for instance. So just shutting your eyes helps a lot. And then I have a method of meditation that's very effortless, and I enjoy doing it. And it lowers the arousal, the physiological arousal. So it just cools you out. You can spend a meditation thinking about nothing but what somebody said to you and hurt your feelings, but you need to do that. I had a house burned down once, and I talked to my meditation teacher, and she said, "Meditate right now." And I said, "I can't. I'll just be crying." She said, "Go meditate." And I meditated for 20 minutes, crying, come out, and I said, "Okay." My neighbors were there, and I said, "Oh, I need this, and I need this, and I need this." And they said, "How can you be so calm?" And I said, "Well, I wasn't back in there." So meditation can be helpful for everybody, but probably more for sensitive people.
So if you have, culturally, what we've done is we've always kind of drummed out the very sensitive people, haven't we?
Well, Margaret Mead made the very good point about temperament, is that every culture has its ideal personality, and it suppresses or just ignores anything else. So you can imagine when a child is being sensitive, parents might just ignore their sensitivity and try to push them or whatever. So cultures vary in how much they value sensitivity, and that then affects the sensitive person a great deal. And it affects the culture as well, because if you eliminate the 20% who are thinking before acting, you're left with a rather impulsive society in which no one is thinking about the consequences.
Don't you live in Marin County?
Yes.
I mean, isn't this, how's this for the home for sensitive people?
Yes, I think so. I think we have a pretty high percentage, although when you're driving around there, you wonder, a lot of big SUVs. But
let's talk about arousal now. Arousal must be the dynamite, the electricity. Mm-hmm. It must be. So the highly sensitive person is sometimes not the most easily aroused, but arousal could be their enemy.
Arousal is their enemy.
Let's talk about that, all right?
Overstimulation. My father used to take us to different factories, and he took us to an orange packing plant, and I've always used this analogy. I like it so well. The way they used to at least sort small, medium, and large oranges is they go down a conveyor belt that's kind of shaking, and they go into slots that they fit into. Suppose you have 15 slots instead of 3. And a whole lot of oranges are coming down at once. You cannot sort them fast enough. And so sensitive people easily get overwhelmed by the stimulation coming in. They know they're not handling it. Arousal comes with overstimulation and also with the fear of failure, of course. Sensitive people don't do as well usually under pressure when being observed, when trying to perform, time tests, those kind of things. It certainly contributes to their sense of being a failure and to other people looking at them as, oh boy, those people really can't measure up.
So if you're a highly, if you're a self-actualizing, highly sensitive person, how's that for throwing some phrases together? You would then say to yourself, I'm being overly stimulated, or there's too much stimulation. Mm-hmm. You don't even want to say I'm being overstimulated, because then you're blaming somebody.
Right.
How do you deal with it?
Well, there's all kinds of ways to get less stimulation.
What phrase would you say to yourself? Would you see arousal? Do you see the word arousal appear with a meter? What happens?
Back off. I need some downtime. I need some space. Absolutely, but also we have to be able to deal with a lot of stimulation in life. So, for instance, being very well prepared. When I did my dissertation defense, I actually practiced the day before in the same room at the same time so that the lighting and the room would be familiar to me. Those kind of things really help familiarity. Having somebody with you when you go into a situation helps enormously. So do noise-canceling headphones and quite a few other tricks. Eye shades to sleep and
what about the nuances in there now? How do you deal with the nuances that lead to this kind of reaction? Or what are nuances?
Well, they're precious, aren't they? We go through life and however much in the good situations, even the bad ones, that we miss what's there. That's a loss. We don't know about that loss. That sensitive people are getting a lot of stuff out of life. I remember interviewing one person who was describing, a sensitive guy who was describing the lights, the golden lights on the windows of a skyscraper across the street the night before, that he had seen at sunset the night before. And just going on and on about this beauty. And, you know, some people might not have noticed it.
My guest, Elaine Aron, author of two books. One is called The Self, The Undervalued Self, but the one we're talking about today is The Highly Sensitive Person, which is the world as it overwhelms you and what's it like to be overwhelmed, right?
Yeah, I was never too fond of that subtitle.
Right. The discussion here, maybe this is taking it back a notch, but also brings up the what you've mentioned about meditation. And I think early in the program here, you discussed how a person can, in the moment, be bringing in the past into this present and also this present into this future and where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there is the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot. I mean, to be in the moment, to mm-hmm. be in a situation. And one thought I always sense about is kind of an accurate description of most therapies is about learning how to be present
mm-hmm.
and be present in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the phrases about be here now and
mm-hmm.
And it's not therapy. It's not the only means by which we reach that. And certainly different forms of meditation are related to being present, letting the thoughts move through, letting the mm-hmm. rest of the experience move through, so we can get neutral, mm-hmm. so we can be here. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you do, Michael? Is that what you do with when you feel that you're being overstimulated, you bring yourself to the present?
I have different tools. Is that I have different tools that I've learned, and it is. It's about and probably about reminding me that I'm okay, finding a place in my body that's a kind of a reminder of, oh, I'm comfortable with that. A lot of times I go to my heart area, my chest, and I breathe, and that's comforting to me. So I kind of remind myself I'm here, because my mind might be taking me someplace. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I allow my feelings to kind of stimulate in my body and brew in my body, they're going to take my mind to go into different thought patterns, you know, which are going to take me away.
So, you've learned that about yourself over time.
Yes, all mm-hmm. of that is so.
These are good things to bring up, though, really. That people, it is possible to reduce the negative side effects of being pulled in all directions, and to enhance the sensitivity by, especially by being in the moment, being sensitive to this moment. You know, the past and the future are very important too, but this moment is what we have, and that's a very good thing to point out.
Well, one of the things that I think lead to overreactivity in people is when you load the past onto the present, and it's somehow trying to remind yourself that we are here now, mm-hmm. and it's not the past. You know, mm-hmm. I always thought the definition, the difference between rage and anger is that anger could be in the present, but rage is always in the past. Mm-hmm. It always means an overload. Mm-hmm. So I think what we have highly sensitive people who are having major reactions, mm-hmm. we're talking about the overload from the past. Now, have you found, and I'm sure you're going to answer this, Elaine, have you found that psychotherapy with a highly sensitive person, when they have somebody who understands their sensitivity, mm-hmm. yields a much bigger result than if they have the average person who is, you know, looking at it and saying you're too sensitive?
I don't see how it couldn't be better for them to be accepted for their sensitivity.
Because in a way it nurtures it, you know. In a way, yes, it does nurture the reaction. Mm-hmm. And if a person's overreactive, sometimes they need somebody to say, no, you know, sober up. That's sometimes.
Yeah, I'm real skeptical of pushing sensitive people to toughen up. I'm more of the school of the corrective emotional experience.
I see.
I'm more psychodynamic than cognitive behavioral. Mm-hmm. So I start with, you know, advice or suggestions or whatever, and they're often very helpful, but I really like to be cautious if they're not helpful. I say, well, why don't we try an experiment, and now we know something from trying that experiment.
Have you run groups of people who are sensitive people?
Some, yeah. Actually, I find groups too overwhelming. I'm very good at running groups, but as you can imagine, it's just so much is going on in the room at once. So it's fun, but...
Are there times, Elaine, when you tone down your sensitivity? Do you have a regulator on it so that there are times that if you're in a position, let's say you're the therapist and you have a client, mm-hmm. you're not as reactive because you've toned it down?
Sure. The difference is that afterwards, I think I feel more of the effect of what I've gone through and controlled. It's interesting. I don't have trouble anymore speaking. I just in Copenhagen, I spoke to 450 people. But what's hard to explain is that I felt so awful afterwards, and it's hard to explain why, because everybody thought I was great and all of that, you know. But I felt awful afterwards, and so we can only to a certain extent control this sensitivity thing. Just, I wanted to say, just so we don't lose it, is that We're now doing functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRIs, with sensitive people. And we just had a couple studies come out. And you can see the sensitivity, the clear difference with just 10 people or 20 people. There's a clear difference in how they perceive, how their higher perceptual processes are working, are picking up on more subtleties. And an interesting one that just came out is that people from interdependent culture versus an independent kind of culture actually perceive abstract things differently, whether they pay attention more to the context or more to the to one thing within it. And they know this, and they've done fMRIs while people are doing this. And the, when you're trying to do the task that is not familiar to your culture, there's more activation. We found that sensitive people, whatever their culture, perceived things, did not have any extra activation. It was like they were not being bothered by their culture. They were perceiving things as they are. And, you know, one of the things that I just like to always get in somewhere is that one of the reasons that I wrote this book and I feel strongly about it is that sensitive people really need to play a role in our culture. They need to be, quote, empowered. They need to be listened to, and if they're not going to be listened to, they need to use their sensitive to figure out how to get people to listen to them. You know, if you're trying to teach, you don't teach algebra to four-year-olds. You figure out how to teach them what they can learn. So if sensitive people aren't going to get it about global warming or something like that, you have to think, well, how can I get them to get it? Because we knew about that a long time ago. We knew about smoking a long time ago. So a society that doesn't make use of their sensitive members is really in danger.
Isn't a person who is a highly sensitive person more likely to be attracted to drugs and alcohol and other things that will quell the sensitivity when they find the sensitivity is not acceptable in the world? I would say that it accounts for most of our addictions.
No, I don't think so.
What do you think?
Somebody disagrees. Yeah, yeah.
Hey.
I think that most addiction, well, some of it is genetic, but I also think that impulsivity is a lot of the problem with it. They did a study of shy people, which were probably also sensitive people in this case, at parties. They thought they would drink more at parties. They don't, because they're afraid of making a fool of themselves. They're afraid of becoming addicts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Most sensitive people are afraid of becoming addicted and damaging their bodies and all that. But they do self-medicate, and that's where they can end up in addiction is, for instance, sleep medication. I mean, they have a hard time falling asleep if they're overstimulated, so of course they're going to take something to sleep. But they don't want to be not functioning. They want to be able to observe.
Yeah, I'd say there's, I would hazard a guess that there might be an interest in the in riding the positive stimulation. You know, when we do. Research on drug use in adolescents and young people. You know, there's a certain group of seekers that mm-hmm. are interested that the drugs might take them on a journey. And in the 60s, I believe that, you know, when it was described in some quarters that part of the, you know, the great drug interest in, you know, with LSD and the hallucinogenics were, it was a spiritual quest mm-hmm. that people were, that something about the society seemed deadened, and people said, boy, where is God? I don't mm-hmm. find God in the society. Mm-hmm. And I heard about this or I saw about this, you know. So.
Well, so that's the beauty of it, I think. And thank you, Michael Morrison. I think that's the beauty of what your work is about, Elaine Aaron, that you're saying that there's a, let's not quell this life. Mm-hmm. Let's not put this down. Let's not just disrespect this. This is something to be looked at, valued. The name of the book, The Highly Sensitive Person. My guest has been Dr. Elaine Aaron. The website is HSS, is it?
It's hsperson.com. And if you go there, there's a self-test scored for you. It's a really... also, I write a newsletter 4 times a year. You can get a free newsletter all about being highly sensitive.
Thank you for being with us. And Michael, thank you for being with us as well during this time.
My pleasure.
We will be back with you soon, my friends. This is Armando Mill, WBAI. You can go to the website, thepositivemind.com.